Have you ever stopped, maybe mid-bite, and really thought about where that perfect piece of salmon on your plate comes from? I mean, the journey it
It's
takes.
something most of us probably don't consider, right?
Exactly. We know it's healthy, it's delicious, it's become a staple for so many. But the world behind it, the farming, the market, it's incredibly complex, high stakes even.
And often pretty volatile.
Absolutely. So today, that's where we're going. We're taking a deep dive into that fascinating and, volatile global salmon market.
And we're going to explore it through the lens of a really interesting player, P.F. Bakkafrost. They're a major force, especially known for their unique approach.
Right. And our sources for this deep dive, they come from some really detailed investment research analysis. So we've got a data-driven look here.
Yeah, it gives us insight into Bakkafrost's operations, their financials, strategy, and really where they stand in this competitive landscape.
It's not just about one company, though, is it? It feels like understanding Bakkafrost helps us understand the whole sector.
Precisely. It's about that intricate dance between, nature, technology, and massive global demand.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Our mission today is to really get our heads around this complex industry and Bakkafrost's unique place in it, that whole vertical integration thing they do. We'll explore how they handle everything from, the unpredictable biological challenges farming fish isn't easy, to those big shifts in global market demand.
And hopefully you, our listener, will walk away with a much richer understanding of this crucial sector.
Yeah, and the strategic moves a key player like Bakkafrost is making, maybe even what it suggests about the future of sustainable seafood overall.
So where should we start? The big picture.
Let's do that. Zoom out first. The global salmon market itself. What jumps out immediately from the analysis is that, well, it's not just big, it's dynamic and, crucially, constrained.
That constrained piece is key. But let's talk scale first. We're looking at a market valued around, what, USD 23.7 billion this year, 2025?
Yeah, roughly that. And the projection, it's expected to surge to over USD 36 billion by 2030.
That's a huge jump, almost a 9% compound annual growth rate. That's really robust growth for any industry.
It really is. So this isn't some small niche market we're talking about. It's a significant global industry, and it's expanding fast.
So what's actually fueling that growth? Is it just, people liking salmon more?
It seems more fundamental than that. The analysis points to a powerful long-term trend. A global consumer shift towards healthier, protein-rich diets.
Oh, the health angle. Makes sense. Salmon's got that great reputation, right?
Yeah,
Omega-3s and all that.
exactly. And it's evolved. It used to be seen as a luxury, maybe for special occasions. Now, in developed markets like Europe, North America, it's become a dietary staple.
And interesting that it holds up even when the economy gets shaky. People still buy it.
Yeah, that resilience is telling. It shows how much value consumers place on it, even when budgets are tight.
But the real engine for future growth, is that coming from those established markets?
Not primarily, according to the research. The big growth engine is actually emerging markets, particularly Asia Pacific.
Right. Rising incomes there often lead to a bigger appetite for premium proteins.
Precisely. And salmon fits that bill perfectly. So there's this massive untapped potential as consumer preferences shift in those regions.
Okay, so demand is strong, growth looks solid. Does that mean it's easy to just start a salmon farm? Can anyone jump in?
Well, that's where the structure of the market comes in. It's definitely not a free-for-all.
No, it's what economists call an oligopoly, highly concentrated.
Meaning just a few big players dominate.
Exactly. The top five companies, Mowi, Celmar, Cermaq, Leroy, and our focus today, Bakkafrost together, they control something like 40% of the entire global market.
40% just from five companies. Wow. So for you listening, what does that concentration mean practically?
It means significant barriers to entry for anyone new wanting to get in. Starting a salmon farm needs huge amounts of capital.
Right. You need the money, the expertise in fish biology, navigating all the complex regulations to get licenses.
It's a massive undertaking. And that concentration, well, it protects the profitability of the established giants. It gives them a very strong, defensible market position.
Okay, that really paints the picture on the demand side and the competitive structure. Let's flip over to the supply side now, because this is where things get, really fascinating and, frankly, difficult.
Yeah, the supply side is defined by constraints, real structural constraints and biological realities.
Unlike growing, say, corn, where you can often just plant more, you
Yeah.
can't scale salmon farming indefinitely. It's not like turning on a tap.
Absolutely not. First off, there's only a finite number of suitable places to farm salmon in the ocean.
You need those specific sheltered coastal fjords, right? prime real estate.
Exactly. And those pristine environments are scarce, they're sensitive, you can't just set up shop anywhere. Geography is a huge limiting factor.
And governments step in to manage the scarcity too.
They do. Through strict regulations, they cap production volumes using what are called maximum allowable biomass licenses, or MAs.
So it's not just arbitrary limits, it's about protecting the environment.
Yeah, it's about environmental protection, sustainable management of those coastal ecosystems, making sure farming doesn't overwhelm the natural capacity.
What about the fish themselves? Are there limits there too?
Oh, definitely. There are biological ceilings. You can't just push fish to grow infinitely faster or bigger without serious consequences for their health and welfare.
So that biological reality puts a brake on long-term supply growth for the whole industry.
It does. Cantali, who are a leading analyst firm in this space, they project only about a 27% increase in global salmon production by 2030.
Okay, 27% growth. Compare that to the demand growth we talked about, nearly 9% per year.
Exactly. The projected supply growth, TGR, is way below the demand growth. That creates a fundamental structural imbalance in the market.
And on top of all that, the supply we do have is geographically concentrated.
Hugely concentrated. Norway and Chile alone account for over 75% of all farmed Atlantic salmon globally.
Wow, 75% from just two countries. That's quite something.
It means a huge chunk of the world's supply depends on the specific environmental and regulatory conditions in just those two places.
So the implication here, whether you're just buying salmon at the store or looking at this industry from an investment angle, it's pretty significant.
It absolutely is. This structural imbalance, strong long-term demand growth, hitting these real constrained supply limits, it creates a fundamentally tight market.
Which is good for producers, presumably. Supports prices.
Yes, it supports long-term pricing power and profitability for producers. But it also means prices are incredibly sensitive to even small supply disruptions.
Ah, okay. So a small issue somewhere can cause big price swings.
Precisely. Just a slight hiccup in supply can send ripples through the whole chain. And that leads us perfectly into the salmon price cycle.
Yeah, let's talk about that cycle. Because if you follow salmon prices, you know they can be incredibly volatile. You said it's the norm. Why is that?
The main driver is usually short-term shifts in supply, unexpected events.
Like what kind of events?
Think disease outbreaks hitting farms, bad weather disrupting operations, or even sudden regulatory changes that force farmers to harvest earlier or later than planned.
And one specific challenge always seems to pop up, sea lice.
Sea lice are a huge one. They're natural parasites, but if they get out of control, they can seriously harm the fish. This often triggers mandatory early harvest by regulators to control the spread.
And boom, suddenly there's less fish available on the market than expected.
Exactly. Immediate impact on supply. It's a constant battle against these biological factors.
So supply shocks are the big trigger. Does demand play a role in the volatility too?
It does, though maybe more subtly. Broader economic factors matter. Things like global economic growth, inflation, how much disposable income consumers have. That influences how much salmon people are willing and able to buy, especially the premium stuff.
Right, so supply shocks might cause the spike, but the underlying economy affects how consumers react to that spike.
You got it. It dictates the demand elasticity.
What have we seen recently in terms of price trends? The research mentions strong prices in early 2024, but then they softened later in the year and into early 2025. Why the drop?
That specific softening was mainly down to better biological conditions in Europe. Things went well for a period, leading to increased supply harvests.
So more fish available, prices eased off a bit.
Temporarily, yes.
Yeah.
But here's the crucial point. The long-term outlook, according to experts cited in our sources, is still for healthy prices that sustain industry profit margins.
So even if you see prices dip at the supermarket, the fundamental supply-demand imbalance means the long-term picture for producers still looks pretty positive.
Generally, yes. That underlying tightness supports the baseline.
Okay, this complex interplay leads us to the regulatory and environmental landscape. It sounds like a real double-edged sword for companies like Bakkafrost.
It absolutely is. On one side, those complex regulations and the difficulty getting licenses create high barriers to entry. That benefits the established players who already have them.
Protects their patch, basically.
Right. But the flip side is constant intense scrutiny from governments, from the public, from environmental groups.
And there are some significant environmental concerns they have to manage.
Yes, major sustainability challenges. Managing fish waste and uneaten feed in the marine environment is a big one. The risk of farmed fish escaping and mixing with wild populations is another. And the use of chemical treatments for things like sea lice raises concerns.
Has this led to pushback?
Definitely. We're seeing growing regulatory and social pressure against traditional methods like open net pen farming in some areas. British Columbia and Canada is a key example, where there's a strong push towards alternatives considered more environmentally friendly.
So faced with this pressure, is the industry just reacting or is it driving innovation? Are we seeing new technologies emerge?
Thankfully, the pressure is a powerful catalyst for innovation. There's significant investment flowing into alternative farming technologies now.
What are they trying to achieve with these new techs?
Two main goals: mitigate those environmental impacts and, crucially, overcome the shortage of suitable coastal farming sites. It's a race for more sustainable and scalable solutions.
What are the leading contenders?
Two prominent ones are land-based recirculating aquaculture systems, RAS, and offshore farming.
Okay, land-based RAS. How does that work?
Think of it like building a fish farm completely on land, in tanks. The water is constantly filtered and recirculated. This allows for full containment, capturing waste, preventing escapes, and tightly controlling the growing conditions.
Sounds like a great solution to many environmental issues.
It addresses many of them, yes. And it's currently the fastest growing segment in terms of investment. But it's incredibly expensive to build and technically complex to operate.
High capital cost, high operational complexity, not simple.
Not at all. It requires massive upfront investment and very specialized expertise.
And the other one, offshore farming.
That's about moving the farms further out to sea, into more exposed, less constrained marine sites. The idea is that stronger currents might help disperse waste naturally and reduce disease pressure compared to crowded coastal fjords.
But that must come with its own challenges, building structures to withstand open ocean conditions, logistics.
Exactly. Engineering robust systems, managing operations far from shore, it's a different set of complex problems to solve.
So for you listening, does this mean these new technologies are going to flood the market with cheap salmon soon?
Probably not. While they offer a path to more sustainable growth, the track record for large-scale RAS projects, in particular, has been quite mixed so far. They're difficult to scale profitably.
So it might actually lead to consolidation.
That seems more likely, at least in the medium term. The sheer cost and complexity might mean that only the largest, most well-capitalized players can successfully implement these technologies at scale. So it might strengthen the incumbents rather than opening the doors wide for new entrants. It's a high-stakes technology race.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly. We have this dynamic, growing, but constrained market facing environmental pressures and exploring new tech. Now let's bring Bakkafrost onto this stage. How do they operate within this complex world? What makes them stand out?
The defining feature for Bakkafrost, the thing everyone points to, is their vertical integration.
They control the whole chain. Or...
more so than arguably anyone else in the industry. They are recognized for having the most vertically integrated model globally. That means control from producing their own fish feed all the way through farming, processing, and selling the final product.
That's incredible control. What are the big advantages of structuring the business that way?
Several key benefits. One, superior quality control. They can manage quality at every single step. Two, cost efficiencies. They internalize processes others might outsource. And three, strong product differentiation.
How does that help in the market?
In a market increasingly focused on premium quality, being able to guarantee that quality and consistency from egg to plate is a massive competitive advantage. It supports their premium branding and pricing.
Let's break down the main parts of their integrated business. First up, fish meal, oil, and feed, FOF.
Right, this is done through their subsidiary, Havsbrun. They produce fish meal and oil, but crucially, they make their own proprietary salmon feed.
And this feed is special somehow.
Yes, a key differentiator is its high marine content. It's designed to closely mimic what a wild salmon would eat.
Why does that matter?
It's believed to result in healthier fish, better growth, superior taste, and higher levels of those omega-3s consumers want. This directly underpins Bakkafrost's premium positioning.
Do they only use it themselves?
They primarily use it internally, but they also sell surplus feed to external customers, which speaks to its quality and performance.
Okay, then there's their actual farming. Let's start with the Faroe Islands. The research calls this their crown jewel.
And for good reason. Farming Faroe Islands is their original core operation, their main profit center. It's known for stability, predictability, and consistently superior results.
What makes it so successful?
A combination of factors. A favorable natural environment, strong local expertise built over decades, and effective management. This translates into strong biological performance, think low mortality, excellent feed conversion.
So it's the reliable engine driving the group's earnings.
Absolutely. It provides a stable foundation of earnings and cash flow that supports the rest of the group, including their expansion efforts elsewhere.
Which brings us to Farming Scotland. Acquired in 2019, this is meant to be the growth engine, but it sounds like it's been more of a challenge.
That's fair to say. It's their big growth play, but it has definitely been a tough road since the acquisition. Scotland has faced significant, persistent biological challenges,
leading to higher costs and weaker results compared to the Faroes.
Exactly. Much higher costs, lower profitability. Turning Scotland around is the major focus for management right now. It's where the potential upside, but also the execution risk, lies.
And the final piece is value-added products, VAP. What happens there?
This segment takes a fresh salmon harvested from their farms and processes it into things like fillets, portions, smoked salmon, ready for the consumer.
And how are those sold?
Often through long-term contracts with retailers, typically at fixed prices. This can provide stability compared to selling everything on the volatile spot market.
But its profitability depends on a few things.
Yes, it's sensitive to the tax rules, especially in the Faroes, and also the difference or spread between the spot price of salmon and those fixed contract prices they've agreed to. So its role can fluctuate.
So we really do have this tale of two regions defining Bakkafrost. Let's delve deeper into that contrast because it seems central to their story. The Faroes, a model of excellence.
It really is. The Faroe segment just consistently delivers strong growth, high average harvest weights, 5.3 kilos per fish in 2024, which is impressive.
Provides that stable base you mentioned.
Exactly. Solid earnings, solid cash flow. It's built on decades of experience in a very supportive natural environment. It allows them the financial strength to tackle challenges elsewhere.
And then stark contrast, Scotland. The turnaround story. What were the specific biological issues that made it so challenging?
The main culprits have been high pressure from sea lice, which we talked about, and also significant issues with gill health. Gills are obviously vital for fish, and problems there can lead to stress, poor growth, and higher mortality,
resulting in those elevated death rates and higher production costs.
Precisely. It's been a clear drag on the group's overall performance and profitability since they bought the business. Management knows they have to fix Scotland to unlock the group's full potential.
What concrete steps have they taken? You mentioned a de-risking strategy in 2024.
Yes, they implemented a comprehensive plan. A key part was shifting harvest timing, trying to harvest more fish earlier in the year to avoid the riskiest summer months when water temperatures rise and biological challenges often peak.
And intensifying fish health management.
Right. More proactive treatments, more monitoring. And the good news, according to the analysis, is that 2024 showed real signs of improvement.
Like what?
Mortality rates decreased significantly compared to 2023. And the Scottish segment delivered its highest full-year EBITDA since Bakkafrost acquired it.
So the first clear evidence that the turnaround plan might actually be working? Gaining traction?
Exactly. It's early days still, perhaps, but it's a crucial positive signal.
Now, central to this turnaround and really their whole future strategy is this large smolt approach. This sounds like their big bet. Explain the thinking behind it.
It's absolutely fundamental to their strategy, especially for fixing Scotland. The core idea is to grow the young salmon, the smolts, much bigger on land, in controlled freshwater hatcheries before they go into the sea cages.
Why do that? What's the benefit?
The longer they spend growing in that safe, controlled, land-based environment, the shorter the time they need to spend in the ocean phase, which is where the main biological risks are, the diseases, the parasites like sea lice, the environmental fluctuations.
So it's about minimizing their exposure to the dangers of the sea, like sending them to a protected boarding school first.
That's a great analogy. Less time in the marine environment should mean less chance of things going wrong, leading to better survival rates, better overall fish health and welfare.
That sounds logical, but it must require massive investment in those land-based facilities.
Huge investment. It's a major capital commitment. In Scotland, the key facility is the Applecross Hatchery. It's now up and running, delivering smolts over 200 grams.
And that 200-gram plus size is a critical milestone for Scotland.
Yes, because it significantly cuts down the time needed in the sea phase there, which is vital for improving performance in that challenging region.
Are they doing the same in the Faroes, perhaps even pushing it further?
They are, and they're even more advanced there. The Faroes operation is aiming for even larger smolts. In Q1 2025, the average smolt transferred to sea was already 421 grams.
Wow, that's big for a smolt.
It is. And with their big new Skálavík hatchery coming online, Their long-term goal in the Faroes is to produce 24 million smolts a year, averaging 500 grams each.
Half a kilo before they even hit the ocean. Incredible. So what's the ultimate expected impact of this whole strategy? What are they hoping to achieve?
The core expectation is to fundamentally de-risk their farming operations.
How?
Lower mortality, obviously. That's huge financially. Improved feed conversion, bigger, healthier smolts should convert feed more efficiently in the sea, and overall more predictable, stable, and cost-effective production.
So for anyone following Bakkafrost, understanding this large smolt strategy is absolutely key to understanding their future.
Absolutely. Because the real material impact, especially from the Scottish turnaround driven by this, is expected to start showing up significantly from 2026 onwards. It's a long game, but the potential payoff is enormous if they execute it well.
Okay, let's dive into the numbers a bit more now. Benchmarking Bakkafrost against competitors and looking at their operational efficiency. Where do they sit in terms of production scale? Are they one of the giants?
They're significant, definitely, but they're more of a mid-tier player in terms of sheer volume. In 2024, they harvested about 90,700 tons.
How does that compare to the biggest players?
Well, Mowi, the world's largest, harvested over 500,000 tons that year. SalMar was around 257,000 tons. So Bakkafrost is quite a bit smaller than the absolute giants. Grieg Seafood is actually more comparable in size, around 77,000 tons.
So they're not trying to be the biggest. What's their growth outlook?
Their guidance for 2025 is about 97,000 tons, so moderate growth, reflecting that ongoing Scottish turnaround. Their differentiation isn't really about volume.
It's about that vertical integration and the focus on premium quality.
Exactly. Being smaller doesn't mean less impactful. They focus on producing a high-value product very efficiently, leveraging that integrated chain.
Let's get into those efficiency metrics then. This is where the tale of two regions really shows up in the data, right? What are the key indicators?
Operational efficiency really comes down to biological performance, the numbers that tell you how well the fish are doing. And yes, the contrast between the Faroes and Scotland is stark here.
First key metric, feed conversion ratio, FCR. Lower is better, right? Less feed per kilo of fish growth.
Correct. Lower FCR means better efficiency, lower costs, and arguably a better environmental footprint, too.
How does Bakkafrost perform?
In the Faroe Islands, they are consistently industry-leading. Their FCR was around 1.10 in 2023 and 1.11 in 2024. That's excellent.
And that's thanks to their special feed and good conditions.
Primarily, yes. High-quality feed, strong biological control. Compare that to a major peer like Mowi, whose group FCR was around 1.17 in both years. So the Faroes operation is top tier.
But Scotland.
Scotland tells a different story. FCR, there was 1.18 in 2023 and 1.21 in 2024. Still decent, but clearly less competitive than the Faroes, reflecting those biological challenges they've been facing. That gap directly impacts cost.
The other absolutely critical metric you mentioned is mortality or survival rates. This must be the biggest cost driver.
It's arguably the most critical, yes. Because when you lose a fish, you lose everything invested in it up to that point, the smolt cost, all the feed, labor, treatments. It's a 100% loss on that unit.
So how do the regions compare here?
Again, a stark difference. In 2024, the Faroes achieved a survival rate of 93.4%. That means mortality was only 6.6%. That is truly world-class performance in salmon farming.
And Scotland. We know it's been improving, but where did it land in 2024?
Scotland showed marked improvement, which is very encouraging. Survival increased to 84.73% in 2024, up significantly from 79.4% in 2023.
That's a positive trend, but still a big gap to the Faroes.
A very big gap. 84.7% survival means 15.3% mortality. While improving, that's still substantially higher than the Faroes' 6.6%. Bakkafrost's own long-term ambition is over 94% survival in the Faroes and aiming for over 88% in Scotland. Those targets show you the gap they intend to close.
So for anyone listening, the key takeaway from these operational numbers.
The massive difference in survival rates is the main reason for the profitability gap between the two regions. Closing that survival gap in Scotland, primarily through the large smolt strategy, is the single most important lever for creating value in the company. Monitoring Scotland's survival rate trends is absolutely critical.
Let's connect that directly to cost structure and profitability then. Where the money is made or isn't.
Right. The Faroes segment has historically been an industry leader in profitability, measured by operational EBIT per kilogram.
Driven by those low costs and premium prices.
Exactly. Low mortality, excellent FCR, plus they command premium prices for their high-quality Faroes salmon. It's a winning combination.
Scotland, however, has been dragging the average down.
Significantly. Scotland has often posted negative or very low single-digit EBIT per kilo because of those higher costs resulting from the biological issues.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. In the fourth quarter of 2024, Faroese farming generated almost DKK 6 per kilo in operational EBIT. During the same period, Scottish farming recorded a loss of over DKK 14 per kilo.
Wow, that is a massive swing from positive 6 to negative 14 between the regions.
It really highlights the drag Scotland has been, but also, flip side, the immense potential for margin expansion for the whole group. It, and it's a big if, they can get Scottish performance closer to Faroese levels. It's a huge opportunity.
Okay, let's shift focus slightly to their overall financial performance and how they manage their capital to fuel this growth and turnaround. Looking back from 2018 to 2024, it's clearly been a period of major transformation.
Absolutely. Revenue growth has been strong, more than doubling from DKK 3.2 billion in 2018 to DKK 7.3 billion in 2024.
Driven mainly by the Scottish acquisition and ongoing Faroese growth.
Correct. The acquisition added significant scale, and the Faroese business continued to perform well.
But operational EBIT, the core earnings, that fluctuated more.
Yes, that reflects the salmon price cycle we discussed, plus the cost of integrating Scotland. EBIT peaked at DKK 1.7 billion in 2022 when prices were very high, but recovered to DKK 1.55 billion in 2024, which is still strong historically.
How did the lower margin Scottish volumes affect the group's overall EBIT per kilo?
It definitely diluted it. Pre-acquisition, in 2018, their group EBIT KK was over DKK 24, and the Scottish volumes brought that average down. But importantly, their cash flow from operations has remained robust.
Which they need for their big investment plans right now.
Exactly. They generated DKK 590 million in operating cash flow in just Q1 2025, showing they have the internal resources to fund those ambitious plans.
And that leads us to their capital allocation strategy. It seems like there's been a clear shift towards reinvestment.
A very clear shift. They've moved from balancing shareholder returns with investment to a phase of really intensive reinvestment for long-term growth.
How is that manifesting?
Most obviously in their huge capital expenditure program. They announced a DKK 6.3 billion investment plan for 2024 through 2028.
6.3 billion Danish kroner. That's a massive number. Where's most of that going?
Primarily into expanding hatchery capacity, building those big RAS facilities for the large smolt strategy in both the Faroe Islands, Skálavík, and Scotland, Applecross.
So it's a very deliberate strategic choice. Say, invest heavily now to improve operations and create value down the line.
Precisely. Prioritizing long-term value creation through operational improvements over maximizing immediate cash returns to shareholders, it's a long-term vision.
But they haven't completely cut off returns to shareholders. They still have a dividend policy.
They do, which provides some capital discipline. They target paying out 30-50% of their adjusted earnings per share as dividends.
And have they been paying dividends recently?
Yes, quite substantially. DKK 10 per share for 2022, DKK 8.70 for 2023, and they proposed DKK 8.44 for 2024. The only recent pause was in 2019, likely to conserve cash for the Scottish acquisition, which again shows they'll make tough choices for strategic goals.
And no major share buybacks reinforces the focus on reinvestment.
Correct. The focus is clearly on reinvesting in the business for growth alongside that consistent dividend.
To support all this spending and navigate industry ups and downs, they must maintain a strong balance sheet.
Absolutely crucial. And they do. They target an equity ratio, the proportion of assets funded by equity, of at least 35%. They've consistently operated well above that, hitting 62% at the end of 2022, which is very healthy.
And how are they managing their debt, especially with this big CapEx plan?
Net interest-bearing debt was manageable at DKK 2.79 billion in Q1 2025. They actively manage their liquidity, ensuring they have enough committed credit facilities to cover their needs, which limits refinancing risk. It's prudent financial management that allows them to invest heavily while still being resilient.
Okay, let's look forward now. The strategic outlook, their ambitious growth plans, the challenges they still face, and the key variables that will really determine their success. They have a big harvest target for 2028.
A very ambitious one. They're aiming to increase annual harvest volume to 165,000 tons by 2028.
From about 91,000 tons in 2024, that's huge growth.
It implies a CAGR of around 12.5%. That's significantly faster than the overall industry supply is expected to grow. Very aggressive.
And where does almost all that growth have come from?
It hinges almost entirely on Scotland. The successful turnaround and expansion there is critical. The large smolt strategy needs to deliver those better survival rates and biological performance to allow them to stock more fish and utilize their licenses more fully. Scotland is the key.
So is that 165,000 by 2028 target a sure thing or more of a stretch goal?
I definitely call it a stretch goal. There's high execution dependency. Any delays with the Applecross hatchery ramp up or unexpected biological setbacks, which are always possible in this industry, could push that timeline out beyond 2028.
So for listeners, it's important to see it as a high potential objective, but one that requires things to go very right.
Exactly. High potential, but not guaranteed. Execution is everything.
Now let's talk headwinds. What are the main obstacles Bakkafrost is navigating day to day?
Biological risks are still number one. Scotland is just inherently a tougher place to farm salmon than the Faroes, biologically speaking. Their 2024 strategy of harvesting early to avoid the challenging summer months proves that.
Even Faroes aren't totally immune, though.
No, nowhere is completely immune. They had an outbreak of ISA, infectious salmon anemia, at one Faroes site in May 2024. That required an early harvest to contain it. These things happen.
But there's good news on the biological front, too. Their investments are paying off in some areas.
Yes, definitely. They're big investments in freshwater treatment capabilities, like new service vessels that can treat fish for sea lice on board using fresh water, have been highly effective. They've achieved record low sea lice levels in both regions recently. That's a tangible success, showing their proactive approach works.
Okay, what about regulatory risk? The Faroes tax change sounds like a really big deal for them.
It is a pivotal development, a major de-risking event. The old system was a revenue-based tax, up to 20%, calculated on volatile spot prices.
Which made long-term planning difficult and penalized selling through fixed-price contracts.
Exactly, especially when spot prices were high. The new system, from January 1st, 2025, is much more stable. It's a hybrid. A lower maximum revenue tax of 7.5%, plus a new 12% special corporate tax only on marine farming profits.
And this new system is locked in for a while.
Yes, secured by a long-term political agreement until 2032. This predictability is huge. It removes the disincentive for using their VAP segment for long-term contracts, which should help reduce earnings volatility going forward. Big positive.
And finally, market and input cost risks. They can't escape those.
No company can. Their profitability is directly exposed to global salmon price swings. We saw that with weaker prices hitting margins in late 2024 and early 2025.
And costs for things like feed ingredients and energy, inflation pressure.
That's also a factor. However, their vertical integration in feed gives them some buffer and control there. And there's a bit of a tailwind expected. Lower raw material costs they sourced in 2024 should help reduce their farming costs in 2025.
With all these complex strategic moves, risks, and investments, the quality of the management team and their governance must be critical.
Absolutely essential. Bakkafrost benefits from a very experienced, long-tenured management team. The CEO, Regin Jacobsen, has been there since 1989. That provides incredible continuity and deep knowledge.
And are their interests aligned with shareholders?
It appears so. Senior executives have deep industry expertise and hold significant ownership stakes themselves. That aligns their incentives. The board also brings extensive experience from relevant sectors like seafood, energy, finance.
And this team has shown they can make big, tough decisions.
They have. The Scottish acquisition, the massive investment in the large smolt strategy, these weren't easy choices. They demonstrate a clear long-term vision and the commitment to see it through, even when it requires significant upfront capital and risk.
Okay, let's wrap our heads around the valuation context. What is the market actually pricing in for Bakkafrost? Our sources strongly warn against relying on simple trailing PE ratios for cyclical businesses like this. Why?
It's a classic trap. For cyclical industries, where earnings swing significantly with commodity prices, looking at the last 12 months' earnings, TTM, can give you a completely distorted picture.
How so?
When salmon prices are low and earnings are depressed, the E and the PE ratio is small, making the PE look artificially high, maybe suggesting the stock is wildly expensive. But when prices are at a peak and earnings are temporarily inflated, the PE can look deceptively cheap.
Can you give us the Bakkafrost example again?
Sure. Late 2024, prices soften. Bakkafrost PE was reported around 36. As earnings fell further into 2025, some sources showed TTM PE ratios hitting crazy levels like 65 or even 80.
Which doesn't necessarily mean it's fundamentally overvalued.
Exactly. It reflects the earnings being at a cyclical low point, not necessarily the company's long-term earning power or intrinsic value. You have to look through the cycle.
So a forward-looking view based on expected recovery gives a better picture.
Much better. One source, looking forward, cited a forward PE of around 13. That's a far more reasonable number and highlights why you can't take TTM PE at face value here. You need a normalized view.
How does Backofrost compare to its peers valuation-wise? Does it usually trade at a premium?
Historically, yes. Backofrost has often commanded a premium valuation compared to many peers.
Why is that?
It's usually attributed to that superior, stable profitability from the Faroes, their premium product positioning, and the advantages of their vertical integration. The market values that quality and stability.
And do we see that premium currently? What do the recent metrics show?
Yes, the premium seems to persist. Using those potentially misleading TTM PE figures from mid-2025, Backofrost was at 66.6, much higher than Mowi at 24.5, or SalMar at 31.4.
What about EBITDA, a better measure for capital-intensive industries?
Looking at TTM EBITDA, Backofrost was around 16.7x. Comparing that, SalMar's forward EBITDA was reported at 8.4x, which was below its own average, and Mowi's TTM was about 13.9x. So yes, Backofrost trades at a noticeable premium on that basis too.
What does this persistent premium tell us about market expectations?
It suggests the market is willing to pay up for the reliable quality of the Faroe's earnings stream. But very importantly, it also indicates the market is pricing in a significant amount of success for the turnaround strategy in Scotland.
Ah, so the valuation is essentially a bet on Scotland succeeding, a referendum on Scotland.
That's a good way to put it. The current valuation reflects not just the existing strong Faroes business, but also a substantial option value assigned to the potential future earnings uplift from a revitalized Scottish operation.
Almost like a sum of the parts valuation. Premium for the Faroes plus speculative value for Scotland's future.
Exactly. The market is valuing the promise of Scotland quite highly already.
What does that mean for the stock's sensitivity? Is it vulnerable?
It makes the stock disproportionately sensitive to news and operational data coming out of Scotland. If they fail to deliver on those improvements, better survival, higher volumes, the premium could evaporate quickly, leading to a derating.
But conversely, sustained success could unlock more upside.
Precisely. If they consistently hit their targets in Scotland, it could justify the current premium and potentially unlock further gains. So for anyone watching, those Scottish operational metrics are absolutely paramount.
This has been incredibly insightful. Let's synthesize everything by directly answering those core questions posed in the research. First, how sustainable is Backofrost's competitive cost position?
It's two-sided. Faroes. Highly sustainable industry-leading costs, thanks to great survival, 93.4% in 24, excellent FCR, 1.11, and feed integration. Scotland. Currently uncompetitive due to high mortality, 15.3% in 24. The group's future cost sustainability totally depends on the large smolt strategy fixing Scotland.
Second, their exposure to salmon price cycles and how they manage that volatility.
Exposure is high. Earnings swing with prices. Key management tool is the VAP segment, adjusting the mix between fixed price contracts and spot sales. The new stable Faroes tax regime starting 2025 is a major positive here, reducing barriers to using VAP more, which should lessen earnings volatility.
Third, effectiveness in navigating biological and regulatory challenges.
They've been proactive and strategic. The large smolt strategy is a bold, capital-intensive response to Scotland's biological issues, with early positive signs. Their adaptation to the old Faroes tax regime, curtailing VAP, showed disciplined management. They seem willing to make tough, long-term calls.
Fourth, realistic growth potential given industry constraints.
The 165,000-ton target by 2028, 12% CAGR, is ambitious, almost entirely reliant on Scotland succeeding. Given the inherent risks, achieving that fully might realistically take a bit longer, maybe closer to 2030 as a base case.
Yeah.
Growth is ultimately capped by their licenses, MABs.
Fifth, capital intensity compared to peers.
Currently very high. That DKK $6.3 billion investment program 2024-28 for the large RAS hatcheries makes them one of the highest spenders relative to size right now. It's a strategic choice to lower long-term costs and de-risk, but it means high capex temporarily.
Sixth, key operational metrics investors should monitor most closely.
For Scotland, absolutely critical. One, survival rate percent, the single most important sign of progress towards cost reduction, 88% target. Two, harvest volume shows growth target progress. Three, average weight of transferred smolt, grams, a leading indicator for the large smolt strategy's impact. Four, feed conversion ratio, FCR improvement, signals better health and efficiency.
And finally, seventh, does the current valuation reflect the cyclicality and growth prospects fairly?
The valuation seems to be looking past the current cyclical low in earnings. Backward-looking PE is misleading. It reflects a high premium for the stable Faroes base, plus significant option value for the Scottish turnaround. The premium shows market confidence, but also makes the stock vulnerable to Scottish execution failures.
What a journey. We've navigated the intricate, high-stakes world of salmon farming through the specific lens of Bakkafrost. We've seen this company with a really strong, profitable core in the Faroe Islands,
making this incredibly bold, capital-intensive bet on the large smolt strategy to fundamentally transform its Scottish operations.
All aiming to drive future growth in a market where supply is fundamentally constrained.
And hopefully understanding this deep dive helps appreciate that complex mix biology, economics, regulation, technology that gets that healthy protein onto your plate.
It really highlights how crucial long-term vision and strategic execution are, especially when you're dealing with volatile industries and, well, nature itself.
Absolutely. It shows how companies try to unlock value even amidst all those challenges.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. As aquaculture technology keeps advancing and that global demand for sustainable protein keeps rising, this inherent tension between environmental impact and the need for production scale, it's only going to intensify, isn't it?
It seems inevitable.
So what new innovations, maybe beyond RAS or offshore that we discussed, might truly disrupt this industry? Could something solve these fundamental constraints without just creating new problems elsewhere? And how might Bakkafrost's big bet on large smolts, if successful, set a new standard? Could it truly move the needle for more responsible and profitable salmon farming across the entire sector?
Big questions. Definitely something to think about.
Something to ponder, perhaps, the next time you enjoy a piece of salmon.